here in the Arthur Coppett Maury Yeston Musical 9, John Guare's play Six Degrees of Separation, and Giuseppe Verdi's heartbreaking opera La Traviata. For more information, contact the Krannert Center ticket office at 217-333-6280 or visit krannertcenter.com. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Caldwell Systems Incorporated. Caldwell invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us here as we begin the second hour of the program. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Freinas at the controls this morning. In this hour of the show, we'll be talking with two writers who have written a lot on the subjects of technology, science, and culture and how those things come together. Our guests are Mark Frauenfelder and David Paskovitz. The two of them will be in residence next week on the U of I campus at the Unit 1 program in Allen Hall. And there will be a number of events. They'll be giving various kinds of talks and presentations. And I think that you can get that information from the folks at Allen Hall if you're here in and around Champaign-Urbana, where we are. I think all of those would be open to anybody who was interested. Let me tell you a little bit more about our two guests. Mark Frauenfelder is a weblogger, an illustrator, an editor, and a journalist. He is editor-in-chief of Make, a do-it-yourself technology magazine. He is co-editor and founder of the collaborative weblog Boing Boing. He has written about technology for a number of publications. He was an editor at Wired from 1993 until 1998, was founding editor-in-chief of Wired Online, and he has written about technology and culture for Wired, the New York Times Magazine, The Hollywood Reporter, Popular Science, and other publications. He is the co-editor of the Happy Mutant Handbook and wrote and illustrated a book titled The Mad Professor, which is a book of science experiments for kids. David Paskovitz thinks and writes about technology, science, and culture. He's writer-in-residence for UC Berkeley's College of Engineering and the Berkeley Sciences. He is also co-editor of Boing Boing. He is the co-author of the book Reality Check, which was based on his long-running futurist column in Wired magazine, where he is still contributing writer. And he has also written for various other publications, including Scientific American, Popular Science, Make, The New York Times, and others. As we talk, questions, comments certainly are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to call in, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. If it would be a long-distance call for you, you live around Illinois or Indiana, or if you would happen to be listening on the Internet, you can use the toll-free line no matter where you are, as long as you're in the United States, you can use it. That's 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Mr. Frauenfelder, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And Dave Paskovitz.
Hello there.
Thanks to both of you for giving us some of your time today. We certainly appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
There's so many things I'm sure we could talk about. And I think initially, just when I saw both of your bios, I'm thinking, well, now here's a couple of guys who ought to have something interesting to say about technology. Maybe as a place to start, I was looking at the list of things that you're going to be talking about when you're here, and that Dave Paskovitz was going to do a presentation titled How to Predict the Future. And maybe we could start there. And I guess I'm thinking about how making predictions may be easy, but making good predictions is much more difficult. If you think back just a few years, maybe 5 years, maybe even 10 years, to the way people were talking about the Internet, we're talking about computers and other kinds of digital devices that were starting to become more common, and we're making predictions about where we would be now and what the role those things would be playing in our lives. And then you look at how those things, the reality, you know, how well were the predictions, how good were the predictions about that?
Well, I mean, the title of the talk that I'm giving is a little bit tongue-in-cheek, which you would only get if you attended the talk. But, you know, what I do is really more about forecasting in a way, because if you think about it, I think of this, the future as sort of this cone of uncertainty. So, you know, it's much easier to look at signals of what's happening currently and sort of, you know, try to guess at what's coming and, you know, what factors are affecting what and how things may play out in the near term. But as you get, you know, farther out into the future, you know, that cone of uncertainty kind of opens up, and it's very difficult to determine what actually will happen. So what I try to do in my work is sort of narrow that cone of uncertainty. You know, with the internet, the interesting thing that I've noticed is that the things that got me excited about the net in the first place, that were, you know, everything that was hyped about it, you know, in the early 1990s, the internet as being a tool for collaboration and communication between people and you know, ways for people to interact and create things together. And share information and, you know, the library of the world at your fingertips and these kinds of things, it's taken us a long time to actually get there. People refer to Web 2.0, which is, you know, technologies like blogs and you know, things like that, that, you know, recommendation systems, things that allow us and enable us to get a better handle and deal with the vast amounts of information that are out there, sort of searching it for news that you can use, and then also ways to better communicate with each other over the network. So, you know, we heard a lot about that in the early 90s, but what actually happened was the you know, communications revolution became this, you know, another kind of consumer revolution, really. And you know, it sort of boiled down to pushing people to hit the buy button. But now I think we, you know, after the dot-com bubble burst, now the infrastructure is all there, you know, the pipes are laid and you know, the roads are there, and now we actually have the opportunity to build some of these things that we talked about on top of them.
Mark, did you want to add anything to that?
I think, you know, a lot of what was promised with the internet has come true, you know, especially being able to telecommute. When I was working at Wired, after I was there a couple of years, they're based in San Francisco. I moved down to Los Angeles and was able to work from a home office, you know, and this was in the late 90s, and things have just gotten even better. You know, now here in Los Angeles, I have a much higher speed connection, and the traffic is so bad in Los Angeles, you know, as soon as I leave the property line, I've blown the whole day. So I am able to get a tremendous amount of work done. You know, both my illustrations and writing and all kinds of multimedia, and I'm editing a magazine that's based in Northern California from down here, and it's hardly ever a problem. And so I think that promise of the Internet, giving people the ability to communicate and exchange all different kinds of information and in great volumes and high resolution, high fidelity, has that promise has been fulfilled, and it's only going to get better.
I'm thinking about going back to pick up the point that David Paskowitz made about how I think that there were a lot of fears I think early on that somehow the net, the whole thing was going to be hijacked by commercial interests, and that really that would be the thing that would be would set direction, would be a limiting factor, would get in the way of it being what a lot of people dreamed that it could be.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose that has happened, and yet I guess I don't, maybe that I should ask the question. I mean, has it really been so subverted by people who are interested in trying to use it to make money that it hasn't? It can't be what people thought it could be, or is it just a matter of you got to sort through you've got to make your way through all that, but it still can be what people thought it could be.
Well, I think you used the exact term, which is subversion. I mean, it was subverted by commercial interests, but you know, now that's being subverted once again by people who actually want to use it for things other than you know, old models of selling and buying. You know, it's a big place. It's a you know, somewhat endless place. And so, you know, there's plenty of room for everybody. And I think what you see is that the things that really capture people's attention and really take off are things that you know, exploit what the net can do that other, you know, more traditional forms of media cannot do.
Such as?
such as enabling, you know, everybody, you know, every individual to potentially reach a large number of people, to enable each person to, you know, desktop computer technology enabled people to become, you know, their own recording studios or their own film studios. The net enabled people to distribute the material and the media that they were making, you know, without the need for deep-pocketed middlemen. You know, blogging has enabled people to much more easily than before become publishers of information. You know, so these were all the promises that we heard, and you know, now the tools have become easy enough, and the you know, internet access through broadband and free Wi-Fi networks and things like that has become ubiquitous enough that you know, a lot of people, most people, at least in the U.S., have access to this opportunity.
I have a caller here I want to bring in the conversation. Let's do that. Someone listening over in Indiana this morning on our toll-free line. It's line 4. Hello.
Hello. This question may not even be sensible because this discussion has started in a direction I didn't think it was going to go. When you were talking about the relationship between culture, technology, and I guess science, I was thinking something else. So I'll go ahead and ask the question.
Yeah, what were you thinking?
Well, I thought that there would be some more historical, I mean, in a long sense, historical in terms of like, mine goes back as far as the previous hour where we were talking about the culture of Greece. What I find peculiar is a sort of a counterculture in our country now, which may have existed in other forms in other countries, and that was my question in dealing with that, is that there are a group of people who accept the statements of science, then they'll turn around and not accept the statements of science at the same time. I guess that's sort of the old cognitive dissonance theory, such as people who will clap and look very fondly at the rockets going off and releasing satellites, but don't want to have a damn thing to do with stem cell research or evolution. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hear that for sure. Mark, you want to say something about that?
You know, that's just the effect of religion, which, you know, for a great number of people, trump science. And so, you know, that's the reality of living in this country and the world too, that science unwillingly finds itself at loggerheads with a lot of religious thinking that contradicts scientific findings, and you know, a lot of the so-called theory of evolution has been a problem. One side says that it's just a theory, but there are two different definitions of the word theory. You know, one is it's an idea, and the other, the scientific use of that word, really is more synonymous with a fact than an idea.
I also think that I think the rockets are actually an interesting comment that you made, that people can applaud and feel this sense of pride in our country in this age of exploration when they see, you know, a rocket go off and that kind of thing, but then, you know, fight against stem cell research. And I sort of feel, and I don't have empirical evidence for this, but I wonder if it's not the fact that, you know, when you're watching a rocket go off or watching someone, you know, land on the moon or watching the president say that we're going to go to Mars, it's very external. I mean, it's almost like watching sort of a football game, right? I mean, you're not really actively involved in that. But when you're talking about things like stem cell research and evolution, they're much more personalized, right? I mean, it's about you. It's about the human condition personally and how this may impact you. And I think people get, you know, a little more jumpy, a little edgier and nervous when you're talking about technologies that are, you know, much closer to home than going to the moon. So I think that's sort of where it comes from, you know, the difference.
All right. Well, I hope that that gets at some of the points the caller was interested in. Other people can call in, make comments, ask questions, take us in whatever direction you would like. Our two guests here have written a lot about technology and culture. Mark Frauenfelder, again, he's the editor-in-chief of Make. It's a do-it-yourself technology magazine. He was an editor at Wired and was founding editor-in-chief of Wired Online. He has written articles about technology and culture for many different publications. David Peskovitz is writer-in-residence for UC Berkeley's College of Engineering. He's the co-author of the book Reality Check, based on his long-running futurist column in Wired magazine, where he is still a contributing writer. And together, the two of them are involved in a collaborative weblog called Boing Boing. And also, the two of them are going to be here next week on the U of I campus as guests in residence at Unit 1 in Allen Hall on the U of I campus. If you're interested in finding out what sort of things will be going on there and you have access to the internet, there is a web page for Unit 1 you can get to through the U of I main page, or you can call 333-8351 and get that information. And of course, here on the show, 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that's 800-222-9455. Certainly one of the big things that has happened with the technology, with the computer and with the internet, is the increasing access anywhere, anytime. We have more and more devices, portable devices that are not terribly expensive and are fairly sophisticated and fairly powerful, things that you can at least put in a small valise or in some cases put in your pocket, and that will give you access to do various kinds of communicating, to get at the internet and do that almost any place. It seems like more and more there are places where you can do that. How has that changed things? And has that really opened up the use of these kind of technologies, or is it pretty much the same people that were doing it before? It's just now that they're untethered.
Well, here's my thought on that. Actually, lately I've been looking at how our relationship to the net has changed with all these mobile devices, with the ability to access, you know, the internet on your cell phone or wireless networks, these kinds of technologies. And I think there is actually a dramatic shift happening, you know, relatively quickly in the big scheme of things. And that's that until very recently, the internet or cyberspace was a place that you went to, you know, in order to access this information. You essentially went to the computer's world to deal with find the value that it offered you, to look up things on the net or access your email or send pictures, these kinds of things. The point of entry, the window into this world, was the screen on your desk, and more recently, thanks to wireless networks, on your laptop. But with mobile devices and the proliferation of this technology, and wireless technology specifically, I think that these tools are starting, these machines are starting to deal with us in our world. So at that point, the internet is no longer a place that you go and visit, but rather, sort of augments and overlays our entire reality. It's everywhere all the time when we choose to access it, and hopefully it'll continue to be a choice in that way. But, it's all sort of tied to this notion of ubiquitous computing, of computers being truly everywhere. Computer pioneer named Danny Hillis likes to tell a story where he was at a computer conference maybe 25 years ago or something like that, and someone scoffed at the idea that there would be a big market for personal computers and said, "What, do we need a computer in every doorknob?" Well, if you go into almost any hotel now, there is a computer in every doorknob, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, as this technology shrinks in size and as wireless networks, are increasingly deployed, the objects around you, the world around you, starts to become sentient in a way. Everything starts to become nodes on this network. So there are objects on the network, there are people on the network, And at that point, the network cyber, the internet truly becomes intertwined with and interwoven into the fabric of our lives, as opposed to just, a resource, essentially a library that we go to.
I think that's a really interesting observation that there was, it was more the case that there was a time that when people thought that there was this realm, this place, cyberspace, or whatever you want to call it, that was a separate kind of a world that had a kind of existence, maybe virtual, but kind of an existence of its own, that you accessed it through the computer. So there was the world in which we lived in, and there was this other one that you could, in a sense, you could visit. I think the interesting observation, you're saying that, in fact, now, in a sense, there's not that hard line between the two, and that in a lot of ways, perhaps not that we're all always immediately aware of, that the world of the computer, that space has become layered on top of our own, in a sense that they're not such separate places anymore.
Absolutely, it's much more seamless. I mean, technologies that are already in existence, your cell phone, for emergency purposes, most cell phones now, and new ones are required to know where they are. So they know where they are, know where you are in physical space. So think about the technology or the services that are enabled just by, the device knowing where it is. For example, let's say you're in a college town and, everyone is used to having these buddy lists online, in the instant messenger world. Well, what if your mobile device has a buddy list as well for the real world? So, I'm walking past a cafe and it says, hey, your pal Mark is in there. And people raise issues of privacy. Well, the only reason I know that Mark is in there is because he's allowed me to know where he is at a given moment, if I'm nearby or something like that. So, that is a seamless transition between, the virtual world of buddy lists and the physical world of going and sitting down and having a cup of coffee with somebody, and the spontaneity of that. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's one simple application. Another is, perhaps I'm, walking around a town I don't know, and I don't know if this, pizza joint on the corner is particularly good. Well, what if I could look at the screen of my mobile device and see virtual notes that people who've eaten there previously have tacked up in the ether that say, hey, this place is great, the veggie pizza is really good, but the anchovies are mediocre or something like that, and so I eat there and then I post my own virtual message that, the next person who comes by and looks at their display screen sees. So it really becomes this augmented reality, this virtual layer on top of, the physical layer that we all experience.
Something else that occurs to me, and again, this I guess this this touches on this idea that people are untethered now. They don't have to be connected to that wire so that they can get access to the net or to make telephone calls or to send emails or whatever. Going back to this concern that so many people raised when more and more people had home computers and were hooking up to the net and were using that for business, we're using that to communicate, we're using that for their entertainment. It's the old argument about we're going to get to a time when nobody's going to leave the house. Everybody's going to be sitting in front of their computers. Nobody's going to talk over the back fence anymore. That computer will mediate all of their connection with the world. Well, that's not true anymore, in a sense, because you can pick up your laptop and you can go out the front door and you can go down to the coffee shop or you can go a variety of other places and you can get the same stuff. So that's getting you out of the house. It may still be the case that to some extent that the machine mediates people's relationships with other people. But I wonder how you reflect on that old criticism and how now, with the proliferation of wireless capability, that either has changed or has not changed.
Well, I mean, the classic example is the parents used to complain that their kids were inside, on the computer by themselves and not being social for hours on end. Well, now they're complaining that they're inside on the computer and having a dozen instant messenger conversations for hours on end, right? So, I mean, I think that the computer, those virtual worlds were just training wheels for real-world interaction, I hope. Mark, what's your Mark? You have kids, so what's your thought?
Yeah, well, my kids are really young. My 8-year-old is already starting to use instant messaging, not to any degree that I think of it as a problem. But I do think that, you know, the idea that the internet, wired or wireless, keeps people at home, in a way, might be not such a bad thing. You know, with rising fuel costs, the fact that people often have to drive places to have meetings and things that could actually be solved by the use of teleconferencing and all the wonderful software tools out there that allow you to exchange information. That's kind of a positive thing. And, you know, if that reduces the amount of miles driven, you know, it really adds up. And, you know, as you know, oil is becoming harder and harder to discover, and the price of oil continues to climb. I think people are going to start looking at telecommuting as a real alternative, whether it's as good as face-to-face conversation or not is a different question, but it might be, you know, a situation that we have to accept.
When you think about how things have changed, it seems that in some respects, maybe one of the significant changes is that people can go wireless and can get the kind of things that they used to have to sit in front of a computer somewhere and get. Now it's possible for you to get more different kinds of things, perhaps faster, more things faster, and on almost anywhere. Are there any other ways in which you think important changes other than that have happened? I mean, is it really mostly just you can get more stuff faster anyplace, or are there other ways in which there are other changes that maybe aren't quite so obvious?
Well, one thing I think is connecting people who have similar interests who are scattered all over the place, so that you know, a number of years ago, I wrote an article for Wired Online about people who collect and breed praying mantises. And, you know, if you're in your neighborhood and you go around knocking on people's doors saying, hey, are you a praying mantis fanatic? Probably unlikely that you're going to find too many people that share that interest. But if you go online and start a website called, you know, Mark's Praying Mantis Website, that's going to get picked up on the search engines, and you better believe you're going to start getting email from other people around the world. And so now these people, you know, have dozens of websites and Usenet groups, and they trade the praying mantis egg sacs, you know, send them to each other by mail, and they have all sorts of breeding projects going on. So that's definitely something that the Internet has brought up that isn't just more or faster or better. It's something that's completely different that you wouldn't have expected or predicted.
That's a great example. I mean, you know, growing up, I grew up in the Midwest. I grew up in Cincinnati, Ohio, and you know, the things that I was interested in, you know, it was really exciting to find somebody who might share the same interests as I did, and you know, beat literature, or you know, even you know, experimental, really experimental avant-garde electronic music or punk or these kinds of things. And Cincinnati was a relatively big place. It must have been much more difficult for people who are even in smaller towns. But now, you know, you know, it's incredible that's what amazes me about Boing Boing, for example. When Mark and his wife Carla, and then later when I met them, I had been reading Boing Boing, which was a print zine earlier. You know, I was always amazed when I would meet somebody who also read Boing Boing, you know, in Cincinnati, Ohio. But now, you know, there's over 1 million people every day who read Boing Boing online, and it shocks me that there are that many people out there who have these same weird interests that we do. And the net has really shown me that. You know, Timothy Leary, who was one of the sort of patron saints of Boing Boing, who Mark and I knew a little bit, his big saying was find the others, you know, find the people who share the same interests and this kind of thing. And the net has really, and you know, made that possible, finally, for people to connect with people who have the same unusual, you know, interests and be able to say, hey, you know, maybe I'm not that weird.
Or maybe I am that weird, and but there are other people who are also that
exactly,
weird.
Exactly, and celebrate. Yeah, exactly.
Celebrate your weirdness.
Yes, yeah, celebrate your you know, mutant behavior. Absolutely.
We have a couple of callers. We'll get into the conversation. Probably I should introduce again. We're a little bit past our midpoint. Introduce again our guests, David Peskowitz and Mark Frauenfelder. David Peskowitz is writer-in-residence for UC Berkeley's College of Engineering and the Berkeley Sciences. He is the co-editor, along with our other guest, Mark Frauenfelder, of the popular weblog Boing Boing. David Peskowitz is an affiliate of the Institute for the Future. It's a nonprofit research organization in Palo Alto. He's co-author of the book Reality Check, based on his long-running futurist column in Wired magazine, where he is still a contributing writer. He's also written for a number of other publications, for Scientific American, for Popular Science, The New York Times, The Washington Post, New Scientist. Mark Frauenfelder is editor-in-chief of Make, which is a do-it-yourself technology magazine. He was editor at Wired from 93 until 1998, was the founding editor-in-chief of Wired Online. He is also contributed to the New York Times Magazine. His work has continued to appear in Wired, The Hollywood Reporter, Popular Science, The Industry Standard. He's also wrote and illustrated a book titled The Mad Professor, which is a book of science experiments for kids. The two of them will next week be here on the U of I campus as guests in residence at Unit 1 in Allen Hall. And if you want to find out about some of the things that will be going on there in connection with their visit, you can go to the webpage for Unit 1. You can get to that through the U of I main page, or you can call them 333-8351.
Yeah, please come by. We're looking forward to finding the others.
The other people with strange and bizarre interests meet up with these guys. And, of course, Boing Boing is a fun site. And people, if you've never looked at it, you know, you can go there and take a look at it. We have a couple people here with questions, comments. We want to get them in and go to Savoy for the next person. This is line one. Hello.
Oh, yeah. Hi. I kind of picked up on that. One comment that people might save money, you know, doing all their doing telecommuting. You know, I was just looking at my phone bill. SBC charges by the minute. And I know for our business that that internet connection plus the SBC charging by the minute, and then you add on about your 30% state, local, and federal tax, it gets up close to $90 a month.
Yeah, that's
over $1,000 a year. Extra cost.
That's why.
Is that extra though? Extra cost compared to what?
Well, if you choose to communicate in that fashion, that's about what it costs you.
Sure. Well,
I don't think that you have a choice but to communicate in that fashion. I don't know what line of business you're in exactly, but you know, you have to do that anyway. And those numbers and those prices are continuing to fall tremendously. I mean, there are people.
I don't see that. I've seen them go up substantially.
Have you tried out services like Skype?
You still have to get around the phone company.
There are you know, several alternatives. If you have a broadband internet connection,
who are you going to buy it from? Who are you going to process it through, SBC or somebody else?
Well,
you have to pay that flat rate anyway, though, is what I'm saying.
That's the thing. I think you pay a flat rate. You get, you know, I pay, I think, like $49 a month for my broadband connection. If I wanted to, I could hook up my phone system in my house to Skype, S-K-Y-P-E, you can check it out online, and have very inexpensive telephone calls.
Anywhere in the world, just for like a couple cents a minute.
Anywhere.
So, I mean, there's ways to do
or
that.
Local calls.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is a lot of these services aren't available even in this town, okay? Your only real choice in this town is SBC, okay? And they provide the DSL services, too, and the high-speed connections. The only other choice is a cable modem.
Right.
And whenever you combine cable TV and you have to you can't buy them separately. You have to get a package from them, and it's about $80-$90 a month.
Well, there I guess obviously the caller is pointing to a problem.
It's not cheap,
and I'm sure that it's for people who live in smaller communities. Your options are maybe fewer.
Yeah.
Well, but if you're living in a small, I agree and I respect that, and I understand that it's not free and not. Although there are free places to get on the internet, I do think that you know, if you are in a smaller community, that may mean that you need to travel longer distances in order to do whatever business you're doing. And I'd be surprised if you know, you couldn't save money if you're already having these services by not spending the money on gasoline.
And yeah, I'm just saying, you know, you've got a choice here of, you know, spending another extra $1,000 in gasoline or spending another extra $1,000 in an internet connection.
Well, I mean, I'd have to argue that spending the money on the internet connection is probably better for the environment than spending it on gasoline.
Oh, hey, I was just, you know, it's not cheap, man, you know, you don't want to let that fool you.
Yeah.
Hey,
okay. Well, yeah.
Thanks for calling.
Let's go to somebody in Chicago next. This is line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Somewhat like a follow-through on the guest that was on the show yesterday regarding science and technology and the extent that I like your perspective on the question of do they perceive a preponderance of research and in science being funded and sponsored by the military? Almost as much, if not greater, than the private sector, to the extent that you know much about that. Could you comment?
I don't have the numbers, but I do know that a lot of research in academia is funded by the military. Yes, that's absolutely true.
To the extent that some scientists who are doing really wonderful things in their area are being told, well, we can't fund you because unless it has military applications, you know, nothing's going to be given your way to help advance your research and so forth.
Well, there's two things. I mean, that I notice is that there's a lot of sources for funding besides the military, and I actually know a lot of professors who are doing very interesting technology research who simply won't apply for grants from the military.
Thank you.
And the other side of the coin is that technology that is in fact developed with sponsorship from the military very often, you know, trickles down to you know, the private sector and for commercial non-military uses. But I do think that that's an interesting and a question and a concern for a lot of people is, you know, what is the technology being developed for? I mean, no technology, I think technology is neutral. And I think that a lot of times people will, you know, take grants, and the research they're doing is so basic that they you know, think of it as you know, not having a direct immediate military benefit. But obviously, if the military is funding them, they don't seem to think that way.
All right, let's talk with someone else in a nearby community, Belgium. This is line number 2. Hello.
Hello. Good morning. I think earlier I heard you mention a person's name by the name of Danny Hollis.
Hillis.
Do you? I just recently came to this individual's exploits. He sounds like a very interesting people. Do either of you people know him?
Mark, you know him, don't you? A little bit.
I've met him. He lives. He lives near me, and.
Lives out in San Francisco, doesn't he?
No, he's in Southern California.
Southern California.
Yeah.
But he's up here a lot. He has a company that's based down south and also up here.
The Long Now or something?
Yeah.
The Long Now Foundation is kind of a nonprofit project and think tank that he's involved with. And then he also is a co-founder of a company called Applied Minds.
Yes.
Has a lot of interesting science-based projects. One of them that they recently announced was a device that you could set up in an office that uses cubicles instead of closed-door offices. And when you turn on the device, it makes it impossible for people outside your cubicle to hear your conversation. It kind of garbles what you say so that you can have private conversations in a cubicle.
He seems to be a very amazing individual. I just recently came to him, and I just thought I'd find another little avenue to him. Thank you very much.
Yeah, and also, I think it was last week's issue of Newsweek. You could probably look it up online. Has a quite a lengthy profile on Danny, written by Stephen Levy.
Yeah, if you go to boingboing.net and search Danny Hillis, I posted something with a link to that profile, so there's probably a few references to Long Now and also to Danny Hillis's work. Definitely great food for thought coming from those people.
All right, let's go to, let's see, back here to Urbana for another caller, line three. Hello.
Hi there.
Mm-hmm.
I want to go back to your example of the praying mantises, and it occurred to me while I was listening, you know, people finding each other on the internet, that I actually found my girlfriend, who's in a very small town in California, over the internet.
Excellent.
And you know, it's funny because I'm really hesitant to tell this to people because it's kind of I originally found it pretty embarrassing, but then when I started to tell person after person, they were like, "Oh yeah, I know somebody else who like my sister found her husband on."
I know many people who found their partner on the net. I think that the stigma of that is fortunately faded away.
Yeah, I'm kind of thankful for that. I was just wondering if you had any thoughts on, like, you know, how this is kind of changing. I mean, it actually has really changed my view of, I just wonder now how anybody finds anybody.
Without the net, right?
That's
a good question. I mean, the interesting thing for me is that, you know, early on when people were meeting people in, like, America Online chat rooms, is that, yes, it's true that people could pretend to be someone they were not, although I think eventually you find out and that kind of thing. But, okay, let's pretend that people are being honest, and a lot of people are. You probably were. You know, what your interaction is with that person is literally just words on a screen. And I think that kind of connection you're making with somebody where it's, you know, pure thought communication, you know, text conversation, you know, probably for a long period of time before you actually meet them face to face, is a really interesting, you know, way to approach a relationship. I think that in some ways people who meet people online in that sense and develop a relationship online before meeting them in person, I've never done that, but the relationship, I think, you know, goes much deeper, much more quickly. At least that's what my understanding is based on, you know, talking with friends who've done that.
Yeah. It's really interesting because everything's kind of backwards. We really got to know each other's minds really well, and
exactly.
Now we get used to each other's physical beings.
Exactly. It's really interesting.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Good for you. Congrats.
Well,
thank you.
Thanks for the call. Let's go to somebody who's listening, obviously on the internet in New York, Slaterville Spring, New York, line one. Hello.
Hi guys. I am. Grew up in the 80s with computers in the pre-window days, and in frequented BBSs and things like that. Kind of.
Yeah, so do Mark and I.
Okay, so before the internet really was on the scene, and over the years, I got my experience was that I found myself spending a lot of time fixing problems on computers, particularly in the Microsoft world, and it wasn't until graduate school. In the late 90s when I discovered the GNU/Linux operating system.
Yeah.
And once I did that, it was just like the old days, you know, where you could do all kinds of interesting things. And you guys obviously know that and are participating in this kind of creativity with Make. And I wondered, I mean, I think an analogy that's been used is in the 50s, every guy knew how to work on a car.
Mm-hmm.
And as we move on to an era where free software is becoming more and more accessible and common, we're seeing kind of a similar evolution in computing. And I just wondered if you had any comments on that kind of thing.
Mark, that's your boat, man.
Well, I think that, you know, like you were saying, the car analogy is good. When the Model T first came out, it came with a quite extensive, sophisticated set of specialized tools because part of the deal was when you bought a Model T, you were expected to fix them because the service infrastructure wasn't set up for it. And so to be a user of a car, you also had to be your own repairman. And the same holds true, you know, today to a large extent for computer systems. Even, you know, Macintosh, which is supposedly the easiest one, there's still, you know, a lot of people have problems when something goes wrong with it. They have to ask, you know, the relative, the cousin or the aunt or somebody who knows about them to fix them. And I think we're going to be there for a long time because computers are continuing to become more and more sophisticated and stuff. There are certain branches of computing, I think, you know, like cell phone technology and stuff that is more robust, and you don't really need to be your own repair person or innovator to use the services on them. But if you want to be on the cutting edge, then, you know, you better bring your toolbox along with you.
Colin, does that get at your question?
Well, I was actually wondering, you know, so you mentioned that the Model T came with an extensive set of tools and an owner's manual, and really up until the spread of free software and the set of tools was rather limited for any given user, and now people can read documentation, find examples, use tutorials, all kinds of things to make real the ideas that they have, and yeah. I think that's a really fun and interesting.
Oh, definitely. For people who are interested in tinkering and creating things, things have never been better because of the open software model that was developed, you know, especially with the development of Linux. And for listeners who don't know what open source means, basically it's kind of a collaborative model of developing software and even hardware by pooling talent so that people from all over the planet work on different chunks of a project, and there's kind of a project leader who oversees the process. And that's how, you know, excellent products like the Firefox browser were developed using open source.
Well, thank you very much.
No, thanks.
Yeah,
just
thanks.
It's interesting. I'm really interested in the comment that Connor made, because it seems on the one hand, while it is true that people who are tinkerers who feel like they can do it, there are more tools for them to do more interesting things. At the same time, it seems that it's become easier to manage to do what you want to do and almost not know anything. You can't know nothing, because then you really do, if you do have a problem, then you do have to go, you're calling out for your coworker or your kids or your friends or your next door, somebody who really does know. And I guess I wonder how over time those two, that bifurcation is it just going to get, you know, wider, or are there going to be somehow, are more people, particularly young people, as they come up and they're familiar with the hardware and the software, that are going to be just more comfortable with it and able to do more things and won't have to yell for help quite so much?
Yeah, I think, you know, if you, especially people who have grown up never not having a computer in their house, you know, the computer to them is like a TV. It's something that's just always been part of their lives. They definitely will be more comfortable with using it, and it will just feel like a familiar thing to them. But, you know, by their nature, computers are such general-purpose, complicated things that they'll always be a little more complex than other technologies. You know, and that's the wonderful thing about them, I think. And they present a tremendous opportunity for people who do want to roll up their sleeves and try out things.
you know, everything from, you know, virtual assembly of molecules to you know, having their own radio station on the computer. I mean, it's amazing that one machine can do both of those things.
We're going to have to stop because we've used the time here. For people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, whoever, I want to mention again our guests, Mark Fraunfelder, Dave Peskowitz, will be guests in Unit 1, guest in residence at Unit 1 in Allen Hall next week on the campus. If you'd like to find out about some of the various presentations and talks they're going to be giving, either you can go to the webpage for Unit 1, and the easiest way is to go through the U of I main webpage, or you can call them at 333-8351. Again, Mark Fraunfelder, he's the editor-in-chief of MAKE, a do-it-yourself technology magazine, co-editor and founder of the collaborative weblog Boing Boing. He was editor at Wired and continues to contribute to Wired and other publications. David Peskowitz is writer-in-residence for UC Berkeley's College of Engineering. He's also co-editor at Boing Boing. He's an affiliate of the Institute for the Future in Palo Alto, co-author of the book Reality Check, based on his long-running futurist column in Wired, where he's still contributing writer. Mr. Fraunfelder, Mr. Peskowitz, thanks very much.
Thanks. We had a great time.
I appreciate it.
Thank you.
See you later.
Okay. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Owens Funeral Home at the corner of Elm and University in Champaign, locally owned and operated, serving families since 1925. Owens Funeral Home invites you to join them in supporting public radio. The broadcast is also made possible today by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign, and the staff there at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting AM 580. That is it for us here on Focus, but we want you to stay tuned because there's much more coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host for the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk with one of the participants of the scientific conference devoted to the benefits of walking, now underway at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Following the 1 o'clock news this afternoon, we'll talk with Larry Cohen. He's the founder of the Prevention Institute, and he's a longtime advocate of developing policies that support health and wellness. Let's take a look at what's happening now on the Chicago Board of Trade. December wheat, 337, down 6.5. March, 351.25, down 6.25. December corn, 201.5, down 2. March corn, 214, down 2.25. May, 222.25, down 1.75. December, 246.5, down 1.25. November beans, 588.75, up 1/2. January, 6 even, that down 1.5. March beans, 608, that up 2. October meal, 175 even, unchanged. October